headlines. Top U.S. Republicans support President Trump's efforts to challenge presidential election results, despite the lack of evidence of significant fraud. The Taliban militant group calls on U.S. President-elect Joe Biden to stay committed to an agreement to withdraw American troops from Afghanistan. And Palestinians declare 3 days of mourning for Saab Erekat, the chief Palestinian negotiator who died after contracting COVID-19. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. In the U.S., top Republicans, including the Senate Majority Leader, have supported President Donald Trump's efforts to challenge election results.
And the courts are here to work through concerns. Our institutions are actually built for this. We have the system in place to consider concerns. And President Trump is 100% within his rights to look into allegations of irregularities and weigh his legal options.
McConnell added he had met with Attorney General William Barr about the issue. Barr has already given federal prosecutors the green light to pursue allegations of voting irregularities across the U.S. That came after Trump's campaign unveiled a lawsuit against election officials in Pennsylvania, following similar suits in several other states. The campaign has alleged that Pennsylvania's mail-in voting system lacked the transparency that in-person balloting had. Trump has said he lost the election to his Democratic rival Joe Biden due to fraud, but has offered no evidence for his claim.
The United States has not been so divided in recent memory as there are two people claiming to be president. The mainstream media rushed to accept Joe Biden's declaration of victory, even though he has an average lead of only 32,000 votes in three states in a vote which is not even finished counting yet. Donald Trump has also claimed victory prematurely. It appears half the country believes Biden is the president-elect, while the other half believes Trump is the president-elect. No one knows what will happen next, and many fear tensions could elevate into violence.
Joe Biden has won. Trump may contest it, but the evidence is there. There is no illegal things regarding vote. The system has worked, and it will continue. One man will not ruin this system for us. Joe Biden is now our president.
And one thing I want to add, it's not Republican versus Democrat. We are Americans.
America is special in our country.
Period.
But mail-in ballots were used in unprecedentedly massive numbers, and the vote's legality has been openly disputed for many months. It seems certain the courts will ultimately decide the legality of the vote, and maybe even who won, as in the year 2000, which caused massive political alienation, cultural division, and mistrust. The lack of trust is also because the U.S. election process is considered the worst of any of the core Western democracies. That's according to the Harvard-based Electoral Integrity Project, whose 2019 index ranked U.S. elections just 57th in the world. Pro-Biden corporate media is seemingly acting as if there is no dispute at all, while skeptical pro-Trump outlets insist this unique election must be vetted by the courts, and that Trump must not concede before that process is finished.
I think he'll just give it up eventually. People will stop giving him airtime, stop giving him attention, and he'll just give up. He'll figure out another way to be in the news and all over the place.
Both sides appear to be bewildered by the stance of the other side, and both sides are certain of their own righteousness. With two presidents, many say the U.S. election could not have turned out worse, and the worst seems yet to come. Rami Mazahiri, Chicago.
The U.N. has criticized the U.S. over a host of issues related to its human rights record. In a session dubbed the Universal Periodic Review, the U.N. Human Rights Council raised the issues of police brutality, racial discrimination, and mistreatment of migrants in the U.S. under the administration of President Donald Trump. Several member states also called on the U.S. to reverse the decision to withdraw from the U.N. rights body and to end sanctions on members of the International Criminal Court. The Council expressed hope that the next U.S. administration would work to roll back what it called Trump's harmful policies. All U.N. members undergo the review every 4 to 5 years. Monday marked Washington's third review since 2015. Political activist Life Malcolm says that the U.S. disregards international laws as well as the U.N. recommendations on human rights.
In 2011, the United States, the UPR had a review of the United States for similar things. They called it then systemic racism, and they mentioned the brutal tactics that the United States impose on African people here through their police force all the time. But the United States consistently disregards these recommendations by the United Nations and the UPR. So while it's good that the United Nations UPR makes these recommendations, what's clear is the United States is a dictatorship that rules without regard for law. I mean, it's interesting, this go around, they call the, you know, the United Nations and the UPR attempts to attribute what's occurring here now to the Trump administration. But as I just mentioned, in 2001, Donald John Trump wasn't the president, it was George W. Bush. In 2009 and in 2015, in 2011, I think I mentioned that year too, it was Barack Hussein Obama who was the president. And now this thing is happening with Trump. So it's not whoever's in the White House, it's the United States itself.
Markets in Asia have rallied following news of progress in the development of a vaccine for COVID-19 that has battered the world economy. Tokyo, Hong Kong, Sydney, and Jakarta all rose more than 1% on Tuesday. Singapore and Manila surged over 3%. There were also modest gains in Seoul, Shanghai, and Wellington. The strong performance was led by companies including airlines, which have been hammered for most of the year by virus lockdowns. The gains in Asian markets followed the positive lead overnight from the U.S. and Europe. Hopes for an end to the pandemic has risen after a U.S. pharmaceutical giant and its German partner said Monday that the vaccine was more than 90% effective in preventing infections. Political commentator Andrew Leung believes that there is no guarantee that markets will continue to rise in the coming weeks following their latest gains in the wake of good news on the COVID vaccine.
Well, the market has been in the doldrums for too long, and everybody's waiting for some sort of good news. Let's not forget that this vaccine, even though it's a kind of breakthrough, is still 90%, not 100% effective. So it remains to be seen whether it's going to pass all the hurdles. And secondly, even if it has passed all the hurdles, it's a question of how many people are going to receive the vaccine, bearing in mind, first of all, to what extent the supply will be able to meet the global demand. And secondly, I think that the chances are that the vaccine will be geared towards protecting all the paramedics, the nurses, the frontline medical staff. But nevertheless, it is welcome news. And obviously, as I said, that the market has been waiting for something like this for a long time. But let's beware of too much euphoria. And then let's not, the market is only registered, 1 or 2% maximum at the moment. So it's a kind of cautious optimism. But apart from the vaccine, there's also the question of the seeming to be the end of the U.S. presidential election, ending some of the uncertainty.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has declared 3 days of mourning for Chief Negotiator Saab Erekat, who died of coronavirus. In a message, Abbas called Erekat a friend and brother and described his death as a big loss to Palestine. Erekat died at 65 Tuesday. He contracted coronavirus a month ago and was hospitalized last week after his condition worsened. He was the Secretary General of the Palestine Liberation Organization. He served as the chief negotiator during the 2014 talks with Israel. Erekat was also a strong critic of Israeli settlement policy. Coronavirus infections in the Gaza Strip are on the rise amid a fragile health system in the impoverished enclave. Gaza lacks enough resources to fight the pandemic due to the Israeli blockade. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon reports from the besieged enclave.
Coronavirus cases among the general population are rapidly increasing in the Gaza Strip as over 200 infections are being discovered daily. The first community spread of the deadly virus was detected in late August, and over 8,000 cases have been discovered so far. Health officials have sounded the alarm over the rising figures in the densely populated enclave.
The number of infections in the Gaza Strip is high, and we are extremely worried due to the rising number. We are doing our best to deal with the situation. We are working around the clock to detect infections.
The coronavirus has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the blockaded Gaza Strip, COVID-19 has threatened the socioeconomic welfare of nearly 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza as much as their health.
People here don't have access to preventive equipment because they are crash-strapped. They can hardly provide food for their families.
People have been suffering from the Israeli blockade, and now the situation has only gotten worse because of the coronavirus pandemic.
The Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has had a devastating impact on the well-being of people in the tiny coastal sliver. Gaza's health sector is suffering from acute shortage in medicines and hospital supplies.
14 years of the inhumane Israeli blockade on the Gaza Strip have taken their toll on the humanitarian, health, and economic situation. The Israeli blockade has left the health system in Gaza in ruin, making it unable to deal with the coronavirus pandemic.
The coronavirus is fast spreading in the Gaza Strip, and people fear the worst because of the high population density.
As infections continue to rise, rights groups are calling for the complete lifting of the Israeli blockade to help fight the spread of the deadly coronavirus. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Armenia's Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan says that he has reached an agreement with Russia and Azerbaijan to end fighting over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. Pashinyan says that he took the decision after deep analysis of the military situation. However, he said the move had been, quote, unbelievably painful. The announcement sparked outrage in the Armenian capital, Yerevan. There, thousands gathered outside of the government headquarters to call for Pashinyan's resignation. Groups of protesters also stormed the government headquarters and the parliament building. The ceasefire is being overlooked by some 2,000 Russian peacekeepers. The Azerbaijani president says that Turkey will also be involved in implementing the truce. Three previous ceasefires failed to end the fighting between Azerbaijan and Armenia over Nagorno-Karabakh. Britain's unemployment rate has risen in the third quarter of the year as the COVID-19 pandemic continues to hit the jobs market. The UK's Office for National Statistics says that the unemployment rate jumped to 4.8% in the 3 months of September. It says that a record high of 314,000 workers were made redundant. The figure was up by 181,000 compared with the second quarter of this year. Finance Minister Rishi Sunak says the figures underline the scale of the challenges that Britain is facing. The country has been forced to impose strict lockdown measures to contain the virus that has hit its economy hard. Fears have been raised that the global economic crisis caused by the coronavirus pandemic could trigger new security threats, potentially leading to World War III. Maybe in preparation for such a scenario, Britain's military is asking for the Treasury to enable long-term investments needed to modernize. Bianca Rahimi reports from London.
The head of the UK Armed Forces has warned if current smaller conflicts escalate out of control, drawing in more countries and weapons, World War III might break out. In a Remembrance Day interview with Sky News, General Sir Nick Carter said the world is currently, quote, a very uncertain and anxious place.
We have to remember history might not repeat itself, but it has a rhythm. And if you look back at the last century, before both world wars, I think it was unarguable that there was escalation that led to the miscalculation, which ultimately led to war at a scale we would hopefully never see again.
General Carter says that the British Army will comprise 90,000 human soldiers and 30,000 robots by the 2030s. And aside from modernizing and amplifying its own military, the UK is still the world's second largest arms exporter.
Military arms deals worth an estimated £39 billion were approved between 2008 and 2017, a third of which went to countries with abysmal human rights records.
But we have not seen any evidence of that. If we stop selling them the bombs, if we stop selling them the planes, that will have an impact on Saudi and on what Saudi can do in Yemen, because we are one of the main exporters of arms to Saudi Arabia, and frankly, we can't make bombs fast enough for them.
The UK currently has £11 billion worth of orders. So how does stockpiling and exporting arms factor into the UK's World War III game plan?
The UK government has spent hundreds of billions of pounds, large amounts of which have yet to be properly even accounted for, in response to the coronavirus crisis. And General Carter knows full well, I suspect, as do many others in government, that at some point a reckoning for this is going to come. And this money is going to have to be found somewhere, either through tax rises or more likely through departmental budget cuts. And that time is fast approaching when indeed the British government, as indeed other governments, are going to have to start doing the mathematical reckoning for their spending. And so I think possibly what's the motive here for General Carter as head of the UK Armed Forces to remind yet again for the message that is constantly being put out by the think tanks and the media that support strong-armed forces, that is that the world is a dangerous place.
The world is still reeling from the results of the presidential elections in the US, undisputedly the world's military heavyweight. And although Donald Trump's four-year term was the first without a new war since Eisenhower, his administration has allowed military voices to shout down those of experienced civil servants in the development of foreign policy. Funding cuts to non-defense federal agencies and many career civil servants resigning means policy planning is being entrusted invariably to those in uniform. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Taliban militants in Afghanistan have called on U.S. President-elect Joe Biden to stay committed to an agreement to withdraw American troops from the war-torn country. The Taliban said the agreement is the most effective tool to end the Afghan war. The militant group signed the deal with the Trump administration in February. The agreement sets the full U.S. withdrawal as a precondition for a Taliban ceasefire with the Afghan government. Washington has promised to pull all forces out of Afghanistan by May 2021, but NATO has ruled out an early exit, saying that it hinges on the security situation. Violence has surged there over the past months, despite the U.S. deal. Let's bring in James Tweedy, who's a journalist and commentator from Plymouth, to talk to us about this. James Tweedy, do you think that the approach that the president-elect Biden will have on Afghanistan will remain the same as his predecessor?
It's hard to tell. I mean, this statement from the Taliban is fairly neutral on the face of it, but the question is, why do they make it now, when the peace deal is, you know, has already been signed and they are in talks with the government in Kabul? I note that the president of Afghanistan, Ashraf Ghani, I think just yesterday called on Biden to remain committed to helping his government, and some MPs in the Afghan parliament went further and said that Biden should keep troops in Afghanistan. So yes, I mean, on one hand, it would be politically difficult in a way for Biden to renege on the peace deal and to try and maintain the occupation, because it would be unpopular at home. And, you know, people in the U.S. are already optimistic that their troops are going to come home, because the current president has said they will be out by Christmas. But on the other hand, it would be quite easy for the U.S., as it has done so, you know, before in many countries, to engineer some sort of incident which would justify breaking the deal and resuming hostilities with the Taliban. So I think that, you know, and by the way, the Taliban, if you remember, a few weeks ago endorsed President Trump for re-election. And also, on the other hand, I mean, it does still remain to be seen who really won this election, by the way. I think things are not 100% certain, by the way.
Thank you for that, James Tweedy, journalist and commentator there from Plymouth. Many thanks. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees says it lacks funds to pay the salaries of its employees. The UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East says it needs to raise $70 million by the end of the month to be able to pay full salaries for the months of November and December. The funding shortfall affects 28,000 staffers in the occupied West Bank and Gaza, among other places in the region. The agency spokeswoman said that UNRWA never recovered from the total funding cut imposed by Donald Trump's administration in 2018. Tamara Al-Rifai expressed optimism that U.S. President-elect Joe Biden's administration will restore Washington's annual $300 million aid. UNRWA runs schools and provides health services, as well as other humanitarian aid, to an estimated 5.7 million Palestinian refugees. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Firm against the disbelievers, compassionate among themselves.
There is a verse in the Quran, Surah 48, verse 29, that says, Muhammad is the messenger of Allah, and those with him are firm against the disbelievers, compassionate among themselves. In the Battle of Ahzab, the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, entered into negotiations with the enemy. But it was not usual negotiations. The details of these negotiations are recorded in history. Battles and negotiations were both carried out in a solid manner. Cooperation was also carried out firmly. That is the meaning of the phrase firm against the disbelievers. The phrase compassionate among themselves means that Muslims are lenient with one another. Muslims do not treat each other firmly. It is time for expressing affections when Muslims are together.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Resistance at the beginning of Baysat resulted in 3 years of unbelievable resistance in Shaybe Abi Talib. They lived in the sizzling sun in a valley near Mecca for 3 years. There were no plants and no water, and this is no joke. The Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, Abi Talib, Khadija, and all Muslims and their families lived in this valley, in the holes of the mountains. They had blocked all the ways so that they had no access to foodstuff. Sometimes, when it was time for Hajj, in which according to the rules of the ignorance era, no one was allowed to start a war. They were allowed to enter the town. But Abu Jahl, Abu Lahab, and other chiefs of Mecca had told their servants and children to pay twice the price and buy whatever the early Muslims needed to buy. They had been told to prevent Muslims from buying their requirements at a shop. It is no joke living in such difficult conditions for 3 years. It is such resistance and the heart that relies on Allah that gives rise to such solidity and makes people be patient.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Thank you.
the news line.
Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden has been declared the winner of the bitterly divisive U.S. election, denying President Donald Trump a second term in the White House. Several U.S. news networks, including the Associated Press, CNN, and Fox News, made the call after Biden increased his lead in the battleground state of Pennsylvania, with vote counting still ongoing in several states. His win in Pennsylvania gave him enough electoral votes needed to enter the White House. His supporters poured into the streets in front of the White House in Washington, D.C., and several other cities across the country to celebrate the victory. However, the election results represent a widening rift in the American society. Even though Joe Biden received over 75 million votes, breaking the record for more popular votes than any other president in U.S. history, President Donald Trump managed to garner more than 70 million votes.
There's growing political division in the United States to a level that hasn't been seen in a really long time. You have crumbling infrastructure across the country. You have rising unemployment. They're talking about a second and third lockdown in the United States. The economic situation is really dire. And so two wings of the ruling parties in the United States are fighting against each other.
Many observers had anticipated that the outcome of the election would be disappointing for either side if the other secured victory. But the tight race between the two candidates shows how polarized the American public has become. Outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump has repeatedly made allegations of election fraud and vowed to challenge the results in court.
And there are many instances which will be reported very shortly. There's tremendous litigation going on. And this is a case where they're trying to steal an election. They're trying to rig an election.
He has challenged the results in several states, including Arizona, where the president's campaign filed a lawsuit alleging that Maricopa County incorrectly rejected votes cast by in-person voters on Election Day. In a statement, Trump said Biden is rushing falsely to pose as the winner and the election is far from over. This is despite that a stream of heads of state have already congratulated Biden on his election victory. Trump's unsubstantiated claims about the election results and the possibility of fraud are adding fuel to the already smoldering fire burning in the U.S. society. Trump supporters, some carrying weapons, have rallied in several U.S. cities protesting the results and echoing the president's allegations of fraud, saying the election was stolen.
I think what this election has shown above all else is that the U.S. claim of being legitimate and democratic and having free, fair, and quick elections is collapsing. Nobody believes that myth anymore. And the fact that a country like Bolivia, for example, had faster, more efficient elections even after a coup than the United States just goes to show that.
President-elect Joe Biden seems to have recognized the threat. In his victory speech, he pledged to heal what he called a divided America.
For all those of you who voted for President Trump, I understand the disappointment tonight. I've lost a couple times myself, but now, let's give each other a chance.
But how long will it take until he manages to fulfill his promise, if at all?
Outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump made it no secret that he was on the warpath when it came to China. Not only did he spark a contentious trade war with the Chinese, but he also brazenly stated that the COVID-19 virus was Chinese-made, sparking notions of racism, which, along with his disastrous handling of the virus in the U.S., likely cost him his place at the White House. It's therefore strange to see a senior U.S. Air Force commander stating that U.S. troops in the region should prepare for conflict in the near future, echoing tones stated by Chinese President Xi Jinping during a recent visit to a military barracks in China. In spite of the ongoing election saga taking place in the US, the Americans claim that the Chinese are taking part in malicious activities around the Pacific Rim, and in particular in the South China Sea, stating that China is misaligned with international law. Yet it can be argued that the polar opposite is true, as the US seek to provoke and agitate the Chinese
by sending senior representatives to Taiwan, as well as stoking the flames in the recent tensions in Hong Kong, suggesting that if anyone should be claiming foul play, it's the Chinese over the Americans. It therefore remains to be asked as to whether the Americans are more eager to start a conflict than China. With the US already embroiled in a host of conflicts around the world, could the US then be seeking to start another with its greatest rival China, not only to cement its place as a world power, but also to stem the rise of the Chinese emerging as a threat to the US hegemony?
I can say that for sure this kind of provocative statement, they come from the United States. They don't come from China. From China there is no, basically no statement or will to provoke a war, basically.
When Donald Trump paid a visit to India, many claimed that the partnership formed between Modi and Trump was aimed at sending a message to another regional player, namely China, and it seems that the predictions were correct. The US has also expanded its regional and global sphere of influence further, as it seems that both Germany and Australia have joined the Americans and Indians in the region by performing military exercises in the area, clearly adding another US-backed layer of provocation towards China.
There are many countries involved, but from my point of view, I will say just the countries that are, for sure in the alliance with the United States. I will mention Japan, South Korea, definitely Vietnam, India, and Australia.
Yet with the election of President-elect Joe Biden to the White House, we may see the U.S. reverse its rhetoric towards China, as Biden attempts to pick up the pieces left behind from the Trump legacy. However, there's one very worrying factor in the equation, namely that Trump still has until the end of January before handing over power to Biden, meaning that the unstable president may still have a trick or two up his sleeve, including the temptation of testing the very massive military that he leads. But as Trump finds himself on the way out, many of those surrounding him have also distanced themselves from the outgoing president, including a vital piece of the conflict puzzle, Defense Secretary Mark Esper, who has prepared his resignation letter for Trump. But for now, it's probably safe to say that all attention has been diverted away from a conflict between the US and China as the Americans enter a transition period, and Biden waits with anticipation to tell Trump, "You're fired."
Israel is undoubtedly an opportunist regime. It once again proved that this week when it escalated demolitions of Palestinian homes as international media were focused on the presidential election in the United States. On Tuesday, the Israeli army carried out the biggest demolition of Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank for a decade. It razed to the ground the homes of nearly 80 Palestinians, mostly children, in the Bedouin village of Herbet Homsa in the Jordan Valley. The Israeli army made sure that nothing was left of the Palestinian structures, which included homes, animal shelters, and solar panels. Palestinians say they had no idea what was about to happen to their homes. The Israelis moved in without prior notice and gave them 10 minutes to evacuate before they started bulldozing. These families are now left homeless and have nowhere to go. Vehicles and tractors belonging to the Palestinians were also taken away. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shataya denounced the latest Israeli crime in the occupied territories. Shataya urged the international community to intervene against Israel's attempt to displace the citizens of the Bedouin village and tens of similar Palestinian communities from their homes and lands. The Palestinian premier highlighted the fact that Israel chose Tuesday night to carry out the demolition because global attention was focused on the high-profile vote in America. The demolition drew condemnation from the United Nations and the European Union. So far this year, 689 Palestinian structures have been razed to the ground across the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem al-Quds. The UN says the number is more than the figures in any full year since 2016. Meanwhile, the European Union has highlighted the fact that over 50 Palestinian schools are currently under the threat of Israeli demolition. The Israeli army routinely destroys Palestinian structures in the occupied territories. Anything built without hard-to-get permits, rarely issued by Israel, is at risk of demolition by the Israeli army. Demolition of Palestinian structures and expansion of Israeli settlements are unending. Israeli settlements have been mushrooming in the occupied territories over the past decades. Widespread international condemnation has failed to dissuade the regime from such actions. Pro-Palestinian activists believe even the toughest verbal denunciation do very little to stop such violations of international law. They want the United Nations, the European Union, and other organizations to use their economic leverage with Israel to force the regime to halt its illegal action.
Well, the majority of the EU's exports to the illegal Zionist entity actually come through settlements. So while the EU issues a lot of condemnation of Israel over its illegal settlements, it needs to really put its condemnation into practice by withdrawing from a lot of its economic and bilateral agreements.
Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against the Israeli occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today as several Arab states are abandoning the Palestinian cause and normalizing their ties with Israel. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back. As many governments refuse to pressure the regime, Palestinians are hoping popular grassroots campaigns against Israel will one day bear fruit.
European countries are announcing varying degrees of lockdowns amid a second wave of the coronavirus pandemic and fears that the surge in the number of infections would strain hospital wards across the continent. Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte announced a 6 p.m. curfew for the country's restaurants and cafes, calling for national unity. He said the restrictions can be eased if the infection curve is kept under control. French President Emmanuel Macron decreed a new national lockdown lasting until at least the 1st of December. He warned that the second wave of the outbreak in the country can prove to be even deadlier than the first. In Belgium, Prime Minister Alexander De Croo expressed hope that a team of 11 million citizens would come together in following more stringent regulations. The United Kingdom has also joined the countries that have announced nationwide lockdowns for the second time.
And so now is the time to take action because there is no alternative. And from Thursday until the start of December, you must stay at home. You may only leave home for specific reasons.
Boris Johnson added that all non-essential retail stores will close down, but there would be no need for citizens to stock up.
Things are very bad in Europe at the moment. The general mass of the population has lost confidence in the government because of their mishandling, and I would say even criminal negligence surrounding COVID-19 since the beginning. China, for example, went on full lockdown on January the 23rd for 6 weeks and is now on top of it. Normal life has returned, and the economic growth for which China is well known has been restored because China had what's called a full lockdown.
The stringent measures come as the country's confirmed COVID-19 infections exceeded 1 million, with over 20,000 cases being reported daily. The economic fallout of the coronavirus pandemic, massive layoffs, and rising unemployment levels in Europe have added to already lingering concerns about public health. The mayors of 9 cities have bypassed their national governments to write directly to the president of the European Council, Charles Michel, demanding access to the 750 billion euro EU recovery fund. Protesters from across the continent are calling on their governments to provide greater financial support to those hit worst by the pandemic. In Italy, a tipping point appears to be disturbingly close. Angry demonstrations erupted in Naples just over a week ago after a local curfew was imposed. The protests were followed by a civil order in Milan and Turin, where luxury stores were looted. A poll following last week's mini riots found that over 3/4 of Italians believe there will be more violence in the streets this winter. Experts also believe it is quite likely that countries like France that witnessed unprecedented strikes and protests before the pandemic even began faced serious social unrest.
The potential economic damage from the virus and from new lockdowns is, of course, very considerable. Already we've seen European economies shrink at times during this year. And several governments, including the British government, have introduced financial schemes to help companies keep people employed. So, for example, here in Britain, we've had what's called a furlough scheme, where companies are paid 80% of workers' wages while they are, in fact, at home, not working. But, of course, that will be very, very expensive for the country, and Britain and other countries in Europe are running up huge debts and deficits, which will have to be paid off one day.
The stakes were remarkably high before the first lockdowns were imposed back in March, but they may be even higher now.
In yet another embarrassment for the US government, new evidence has come to light that a plot aimed at overthrowing the government of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has shown that the very highest echelons of Washington were aware of what was about to happen, as the plans appear to have been conceived in a Trump-owned complex. The apparent coup plot was instigated in the so-called Trump Doral, a golf course in Florida, where the alleged perpetrators of the act met on the green grass of the 12th fairway, planning to overthrow Nicolas Maduro while circumnavigating the bunkers of the golf course in the process. The failed coup saw dozens of people arrested by Venezuelan forces, with many of the detained being US citizens and having links to the US-backed Juan Guaido, hence proving that the US are more than certainly involved in the plot. The clear failure by the mercenaries to overthrow Maduro in the coup shows that in spite of having one of the world's largest military forces, as well as having an almost blank checkbook funded by the CIA, the Americans have a long way to go before they are able to upstage any government in South America, or for that matter, anywhere else in the world, suggesting that the US attempt to fund a coup in Venezuela is a clear failure and an embarrassment for the Americans.
Yeah, absolutely, guys. It's a catastrophic failure. Just an utterly sort of laughable, pathetic, you know, Bay of Piglets, as it was referred to by many. Not a very terribly serious seeming coup attempt in terms of what the United States has done in the past, but a coup attempt nonetheless. Absolutely, Trump administration's fingerprints are all over this, although officially Vice President Pence has described this lawsuit that we see now from Jordan Goudreau, who was sort of in charge of plotting this coup and signing it with would-be sort of pseudo-president Juan Guaido, who is in fact obviously not the president of any sovereign territory or country.
Yet, as with multiple lies delivered by the US and their failed foreign policy attempts, the embarrassing failure in Venezuela is yet another notch that the US can add to their miseries when trying to destabilize any nation around the world, especially a nation that's shown the ability and skill to resist, much to the shame of Washington. It seems that the US does not seem to care whether it succeeds or fails when it comes to its foreign policies, with example after example showing that failure is a part and parcel of the US statecraft that we've all seen over the last few decades. So-called intelligence leads in the past have all shown how the lies justified by the Americans and their allies have all come to no results, and have left all the decision-makers at the top very red-faced in the process, with one such example of seeing the Saddam regime in possession of weapons of mass destruction. This is clearly the best example of them all. But in spite of the clear failures demonstrated by the US and its proxies, the fact that they can continue as if nothing had happened in the first place is something that needs to be addressed. Yet it's something that appears to be just another story brushed under the carpet, in spite of evidence clearly showing that the Americans were wrong in the first place. The question that now remains to be asked is whether the US are happy to live and let live when it comes to such massive failures. Or will the red mist settle in front of the eyes of the hawks in Washington, D.C., and mean that the U.S. will seek to gain revenge in the future in ever more harder and brutal ways?
Although I am generally hesitant to draw any real distinction between the foreign policy of the Democrats and the Republicans in the sense that They both sort of ultimately want similar things, which is to say U.S. domination of the world's people and resources. There may be some differences here in terms of the presidential election in the United States. Donald Trump obviously is playing to a very far-right fringe of Venezuelans, wealthy elite Venezuelans who live in Florida. These people are not representative, of course, of any of the normal Venezuelan population, nor are they representative of the normal Florida population.
The truth of the matter is, however, that the attempted coup in Venezuela, for example, is nothing more than an easily deniable event of the past, and is something that, like many other US-backed destabilizing techniques, will remain nothing more than a story gracing the pages of Wikipedia, hence allowing the US to continue their calamitous foreign policies, safe in the knowledge that the denial policy is always best, and that any stories that do eventually emerge will never be acted upon.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know. What should I do?
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, all big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. And in this program, we are going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise their children Islamically. The main source is the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. And today we have in our studio guest speaker Sister Salma Khalfan. She is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qum. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for inviting me over, inshallah. We can do as much as possible for the audience out there and convince them of these principles.
Inshallah. So one of the things I wanted us to discuss was about playing with children and, you know, how it affects them psychologically and how important it is.
Yes, that's a very interesting question, and I like this question so much because it implies on children of all ages.
Yes.
Not only, you know, a group of age, like sometimes we see the hadith that says, let the children play until 7 years, but then what about after seven? They're still playful, right?
Yes.
So you don't let them play? No, you do, of course. And here we have different kinds of theories given by psychologists in regards to analyzing and explaining the role of playing in children. And, you know, Ayatollah Ray Shahri has written very nicely about the theories of this, you know, the playing. What are the theories? Just like the Nazariyat, you know, like their opinions.
Yeah.
But what does Islam say? And that's very interesting when he compares it. You know, I like this chapter. When I was reading it, I was very inspired that, you know, he has done it so nicely, systematically, that some of the theories are the theory of extra power. You know, like another theory is the theory of course, we'll look at it in detail,
okay.
But just now I'm just mentioning, outlining the theories, the theory of extra power, the theory of removing tension, that's why the play is being done,
okay.
And then another theory of evolving renewal.
Okay? Evolving renewal?
Yeah, evolving renewal. That
okay.
means giving rise to renewal. And another theory is the theory of pre-exercising. Okay, this might be complicated in like listening to them, but of course we'll explain them.
Okay, perfect. Inshallah.
The first theory he explains in his book, Children in the Quran and the Sunnah, is the theory of extra power. That's why you play, psychological effect of playing.
Yeah.
So he says, according to this theory, when the energy of the body increases more than its normal level, mm-hmm. as seen that when a child plays, then the bodily organs, they feel extra powerful. They want to release the adrenaline.
Yeah.
You know? Now this theory, he says, cannot justify. Why? It cannot justify the motionless and hidden playing of children. Because that time the adrenaline is not being released.
Yeah, definitely.
Right? They're just motionless. They are playing their own, they're writing something, they're doodling something. Right? So, this does not acquire any physical activity, yet they do it. So, this theory is inappropriate, okay. in a way. Then he goes to the theory of removing tension. And he says that this theory that says playing returns back the consumed power means a person's body will get tired after working and doing activities, and it needs a kind of practice by which the tension can be removed. And this tension which is removed is to play. Therefore, the need to play appears when the bodily power has reached its lowest level. And now, when it has extra energy, this theory, you know, it has been offered by a scholar named Skeller and Maurice Lazarus. And this does not identify the playing that is done after full resting of a child.
Okay.
The child has rested nicely, is waking up and playing. Here he says that it should be done, you know, when the child needs a rest. But after the rest, the child is playing. So this theory is also like you can't explain the theory of playing in these terms.
Okay, yeah, that's very interesting, inshallah. So we're just going to take a short break and we're waiting to hear more about these theories, inshallah. Please stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. Sister Salma, you are telling us about the importance of playing with children, and you told us that children even want to play after they're 7. And you are telling us about some theories, like extra power, removing tension, evolving renewal. So you are explaining them to us, and inshallah, I hope you can tell us more because we're very interested.
This third theory is the theory of evolving renewal. That's why you play.
Okay.
So Ayatollah Raishari explains it as so as that based on this theory that has been suggested by a scholar named Hall, H-A-L-L, that children renew the scenes and activities of the ancestors.
Okay.
That were produced due to the needs of their life in their plays. You know, that for example, you know, whatever your father learnt in his childhood from his father would teach that same game to his child.
Okay.
So it's like a renewal, you know, ancestral renewal. That's why they play. So that's a theory, of course.
Yeah.
So, for example, in certain playing like fishing, boating, hunting, you know, all yeah. these were done by their, maybe their forefathers or their, you know, like grandparents. So they even do it with their children. And we have seen that happening to certain cases. But is it the reason that they play?
Mm.
So that's not the reason, of course.
Yeah.
Because the child repeats the outline of the life of ancestors who are even cave dwellers.
Yeah.
So they were not our ancestors, right?
Yeah.
And then even the child repeats things that were done by maybe what they learned in school from their friends, not the ancestors necessarily,
yeah.
right? So this is a wrong theory, of
like
course.
Like in the whole, children just generally are like sponges. They tend to like learn from everywhere, whatever
so.
They see,
yeah,
whatever
yeah.
they you know.
Whatever you know, like appeals them,
yeah.
they would like to do it, right? And also how the mind works. That's very important. Now another theory is the attitude of pre-exercise. That's why they say that children play. Mm. Before we come to why Islam says that that children should play, it's interesting. So based upon this theory, that is the attitude of pre-exercise, which was given to us by a scholar named K. Grews, playing is considered as a kind of preparation in a child for his future activities. Okay? According to this view, the content of playing is formed by the activities that the child must have in the maturity period and adult age. They're explaining that if a child plays more with dolls, they'll become maybe somebody who loves setting up a shop of dolls.
Okay.
But that's not true.
Yeah.
So although this theory points to the function of playing in the socializing of a child that was not mentioned in the former theories, but it cannot yet define all the childish play, like imitating animals.
Mm.
Can you say that this person imitates animals so he would like to now own a zoo when he grows up?
Yeah, no.
That's not the reason to play.
So it's not necessarily, you know, leading
towards
that.
Yeah, all these theories, yeah. So the age of playing according to Islam, which is the actual concept of playing, it shows the psychological effect in the long run. The age of playing in itself. That is the 7 years, the tender age, the childishness of a child. The way the brain activity is revolves around the physical things that you do, the stimulants besides you. You know?
So that is...
As simple as that. Just to experience everything that you want.
Very true. So we're just going to take a short break and we're going to continue this very interesting discussion. Please stay tuned.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "The child's playfulness in his childhood causes the increase of his intellect in his adulthood."
Welcome back, dear audience, to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. So, we were discussing about playing with children and how it helps them psychologically. And you told us some theories that some of the psychologists, you know, say that the reasons why the children play and all of that. And you just lightly outlined them for us and you made us understand that those aren't really the reasons. Extra power, removing tension, evolving, renewal, pre-exercising. So basically what you try to tell us is that in reality what Islam is trying to make us understand is playing is just the natural way a child likes to, you know, remove his energy. A child is naturally somebody who is very inquisitive. He likes to find out things from outside his surrounding. This is just the way the child is.
Yes, that's right. So basically what we are saying is that those four theories that we mentioned are not exclusive.
Okay.
They can be all turned around. And they can be all coupled with each other. So it might be even renewal of exercise.
Yeah.
It might be coupled with removing your tension. And anyway, children don't have the tension.
Mm.
It might be even to let out the energy. Everything together comes together in its place. But it's not exclusively the psychological reason for
Very
this.
True,
it's
yeah.
only, you know, for example, we exclude it out. No. It can be together. So some traditions indicate that the child must be allowed to play until he's 7 years old.
Okay.
Now, does this mean that after this age he should not be allowed to play?
No.
It doesn't mean, of course, that. In narrations, the first 7 years is counted as the period of